Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Tuesday, February 27, 2018. The time is 9 a.m. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this morning, Co-Chairman Hoffman.
Good morning.
Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good morning, Madam
Chair. Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Machicki, Senator Stevens, and Senator Olson. On today's agenda is SB 108, Medical Care Licensing Medical Board, SB 105, Marital and Family Therapy License and Services, SB 165, Comprehensive Health Insurance Fund. We're in Juneau, Alaska, on the fifth floor in the State Capitol Senate Finance Committee room. If you're joining us off-net or online, all the documents should be available through Senate Finance's website. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? Seeing and hearing none, I'd like to direct the committee's attention to SB 108, an act relating to the State Medical Board relating to licensing of physicians, osteopaths, and podiatrists relating to the certification of medical assistants relating to the practice of medicine, relating to the practice of podiatry, relating to the practice of osteopathy, I'm not getting it right, somebody will say it, relating to the assault of a medical professional and providing for an effective date. I'd like to invite Senator Giesel as well as Jane Conway to the microphones for introductions. Senator Giesel, welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, thank you for hearing the bill today. For the record, I'm Senator Kathy Giesel, representing Senate District N. Madam Chair, I am carrying this bill at the request of the State Medical Board. Several of your members have already heard the bill, but several have not. So the purpose and the why of the bill. The purpose, number one, is to streamline physician licensing. Right now, it can sometimes take many months for a license to be approved. I hear this not only from physicians, but also clinic managers and hospital HR people. Secondly, the need for office assistance and clarification of their role, both the unlicensed office assistant as well as a certificated office assistant. So, moving right into the bill, first of all, streamlining physician licensing. Sections 1, 2, 9, and 10 put into effect an efficient method of approving physician licenses, and that would be for the board to delegate to the executive administrator the routine approval of, quote, clean, end quote, applications. So when an application for a physician license comes to the board, it is reviewed by the licensing examiner. There needs to be a criminal background check in place, the appropriate credentials, and no previous discipline, for example, on that license if they're coming from another state. Make sure their education is appropriate. And if all that is appropriate, then it goes to the executive administrator and then to the board, who individually review these applications. Since the board meets four times a year, this is kind of a ponderous process. So the Department of Commerce actually came to me a year ago and said, this section of licensing has some bumps in it, and we can improve this process. And so this is the improvement. If the application is clean, there's no criminal background history, no discipline, the executive administrator would be able to grant the license. The administrator would also be able to issue the temporary license and certifications as needed. The bill itself spells out prohibitions to this delegated authority. For the committee's assurance, first of all, this also would include physician assistants, but this process is tried and true. There's actually another licensing board that uses the same procedure and has for about 20 years. It works very well. Moving on, sections 10 and 11 allow that the board could designate an additional person who could assist the executive administrator in issuing temporary licenses. So the temporary license is for a physician applicant who has completed nearly all the requirements but has a few more things that need to be checked off, but is ready really to go to work, and this would be a temporary license. Madam Chair, the executive administrator of the State Medical Board is on the line and can clarify any additional questions about this particular piece, which did arise in another committee hearing. And the bills, the bill in sections 10 and 11 outline when this could happen. Madam Chair, this change is urgently needed and widely supported. In fact, I met with some clinic managers on Saturday, and when I spoke about this bill and this particular section, the room broke out into applause. Hospitals wait sometimes a year to get a physician licensed and ready to practice. So this is something they are urgently looking to have done. Right now, the backlog to the board is for the board in terms of applications is about 290 applications in process right now. This is largely due to telemedicine. Members of this committee, of course, were instrumental in our Medicaid reform measures and other bills. Telemedicine was part of that and has resulted in numerous applications to the board for licensure in Alaska. Again, the executive administrator can go into more depth on the actual numbers if you'd like later. Moving on to the second subject, and that was assistive personnel in physician offices. So in about the mid-1990s, medicine created some assistants to work in their offices called medical assistants. These were less expensive than registered nurses to work in offices to do routine medical tasks. The problem is that these folks are not licensed and originally were simply on-the-job trained. Now, since then, of course, education programs have come to light, but these folks in Alaska are still unlicensed. These are the folks that when you go to a doctor's office, take your blood pressure, take you back to the exam room, ask you what medications you're on, what your chief complaint was, et cetera, they may give you a shot at the end of your visit. Maybe you're getting a flu shot. If your children are coming for immunizations, these are the folks that give those vaccinations. But they are not licensed in the state of Alaska. And so, in fact, these folks working under the direction of a physician are not authorized in our state law. The malpractice carriers for the physicians that practice in Alaska have become aware of this and have let their insureds know that this needs to be corrected post haste. Or premiums will be going up because, frankly, they're delegating routine medical tasks to unlicensed folks. So this is an urgent piece of the bill as well, and something, again, that the board itself brought to me as something needed very quickly. Section 3 authorizes delegation to an unlicensed person. So you'll see that called out there. It will be fleshed out in regulation what specifically could be delegated. And the prohibition is in Section 3 to prohibit delegation of any pain management or opioid-related activities. Section 6 states that these unlicensed assistive personnel, medical assistants, would be doing routine medical duties under the license to practice medicine, podiatry, or osteopathy. And it also defines medical assistance under Title 12 criminal procedures. So that would be assault of a medical professional. So that's what Section 13 does. So these are unlicensed assistive personnel that we would now recognize that the physician could delegate routine medical tasks. The board itself will designate and list what those routine medical tasks will be, so you won't see them listed here in the bill. Under the heading of medical assistance, there's another issue. So I just told you about medical assistance being prohibited to dealing with anything having to do with pain management or opioids. You may remember when we did Medicaid reform and the opioid bill, we have a prescription drug monitoring database, and this committee particularly was very specific. No one can access that database unless they are licensed medical people or state troopers. We had a list of people. But for medical personnel, they have to be licensed. The medical assistant is not licensed. They're not professionals. However, as the medical assistant profession developed since the 1990s, education programs became more robust, and we actually have several education programs in the state of Alaska, Charter College is one, which educates certified medical assistants, but the state does not recognize them. This bill would allow them to be recognized, the certification being recognized as a license, so that then a certified medical assistant would be able to access the PDMP for the physician for whom they worked. This particular issue was not brought forward by the Board of Medicine, but in fact, I attended a Cancer Society forum this last summer at Providence, and there was a pain management specialist there with his office assistant. And when he stood up to speak, he railed on the legislature as people that didn't know what they were doing in terms of the PDMP and how it hampered his practice, because he had to look up every patient that he was treating himself in the PDMP because he had no other licensed people in his clinic. And so I talked with him at length at that forum and realized that certified medical assistants are recognized in multiple other states. In fact, Washington State is an example that our Board of Medicine could look to for regulation. But if we were to recognize certified medical assistants, that would solve the problem for clinicians in busy clinics that need to access the PDMP. They would now have another licensed person in their clinic. So that is the problem that the certified medical assistant piece of this addresses. There are national exams. First of all, the education programs exist in Alaska right now, and there are national certifying exams that certified medical assistants could take to earn that certification. Yes, it will cost them some money. That's for they and their physician employers to work out, not this bill. But it is a nationally recognized system of exams. So Section 4 calls out the certification process. Section 5 defines the title, CMA, and it limits its use. Section 12 provides for a penalty for practicing without a license as a CMA. And so that's pretty much the contents of the bill, addressing, first of all, expedited licensing, and secondly, providing for delegation of routine medical tasks to medical assistants and a higher level of medical assistant, the certified medical assistant. This is urgently needed, and I've explained to you why those three elements are urgently needed. So, Madam Chair, I am happy to take questions. This is supported by the Board of Medicine as well as the Department of Commerce, and we've experienced no opposition to these changes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Geisel. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator. I did hear this in Labor and Commerce. It sounds like a step forward. I am not clear, though, on the temporary license. How long does that last, and does that take away the responsibility moving on to a permanent license? Is this just, will everyone just get a temporary license and go no farther?
The temporary license is time-limited. Dev Stovern is the executive administrator, and she is actually on the line. I would prefer that she answer those technical questions because I don't have that in-depth knowledge of the operations of their board.
Thank you. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you. Senator Geisel, are there do other states license their medical assistants?
Other states do recognize the certified medical assistant, Madam Chair. I can't tell you how many of the states, but it is extremely common, which is why the national exams are available.
Other questions from committee members? Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So looking at the fiscal note, it looks about another $252,000 from DGF, because it states that professional licensing programs are funded by receipt-supported services to fund the new two full-time positions for this. So this is not coming out of undesignated general funds. This is going to be paid for by the health professionals themselves involved with this board.
Senator Bumenhoff, through the chair, thank you for clarifying that. You are absolutely correct.
Thank you.
Does everyone understand the structure of the bill? We'll open the public hearing in just a moment. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senator Geisel, as you thank you for bringing this forward. I think it's one of those things that having a backlog, and certainly as we look at some of the health corporations that are trying to hire people out there, the delay is detrimental for them being there for very long. So I think it's something that's needed there. But one of the questions I do have is, how does this affect some of the health corporations in rural Alaska that are out there in some of the hub communities, especially out in northern and western?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I have not heard specifically from those particular Native corporations or Native health organizations, but I have heard from, as I said, a very large room, probably 30 managers of health clinics right in Anchorage, and believe me, they applauded wildly. They're experiencing significant delays. I can only imagine that the Native hospitals, the rural hospitals, are experiencing the same thing, and the clinics. And remember, much of the backlog is the telemedicine aspect of it. And certainly we know telemedicine is robust in rural Alaska, or certainly needs to be.
Next question, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Has to do with, as you look at medical doctors and osteopaths and nurses as well, that you have CME requirements. Are they required to have CME to keep their certification up?
Senator Olson, through the chair, that will be a question for Dev Stovern. I can't answer that one.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Olson.
Last question, Madam Chair, has to do with the medical board obviously does more than just licensed doctors, has paramedics and those kind of things. Are they affected by this at all?
Senator Olson, through the chair, physician assistants certainly are affected by this because they also delegate to unlicensed assistive personnel and need to access the PDMP. So the certified medical assistant will help the physician assistant also. The licensing expedition more quickly also applies to physician assistants as well. Thank you, Senator Olson.
Okay, we do have others waiting to testify. We'll get into the bill with Senator Geisel after the public testimony. Just want to make sure that we understand how the bill functions so that we can go into public testimony. We do have two other bills on our plates this morning. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have one question. It says that there are approximately 1,600 CMAs in the state of Alaska now, and it is projected that annually there'll be another little under 500 positions being added. Is that increase as a result of this legislation, or would there be that increase without this legislation?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, many medical assistants go through the education program at our colleges, for example, at Charter College, and choose to take that national certifying exam. Actually, there are multiple certifying exams. And so they have this credential, but they're not being recognized for it. I imagine that more will, therefore, apply and take those exams and hopefully successfully pass them. There are other medical assistants who may not choose to do that. There is an expense involved that will fall on that medical assistant. So hard to predict, but this is a growing field. Physician offices need these medical assistants.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Von Imhoff.
Yes, in the sponsor statement, thank you, Madam Chair, one of the very last things it says, the bill provides for physician delegation of specific routine activities to unlicensed personnel working in physician offices. I suspect that the certified medical assistants' limits of their training is defined, particularly in the national exam, as well as just the scope of their training. So the specific routine activities will be, of course, within the parameters of their training, and that will be spelled out in regulation. Is that correct?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, you are absolutely correct. That's why it's not enumerated in the bill. Some folks get confused by that, but these things are appropriate for regulation so that they can be updated and changed appropriately as times change.
Thank you.
Other questions and understanding how the bill functions? Senator Machicki.
No, actually, it's sort of related to that, but have you worked out your, and I heard the bill in Labor and Commerce, I'm very supportive of the bill, but did you work out the little concern with the AAMA on the certified medical assistant confusion that they were concerned about?
Senator Machiki, through the chair, I have communicated with the Certified Medical Assistant Association and clarified with them the importance of the bill. They can certainly talk to the Board of Medicine if there's some aspect that they want, particularly in regulation.
Thank you, Senator Geisler. We're in receipt of a letter that we'll communicate with you after today's hearing regarding the initials, basically, of what an outside organization is suggesting for Alaska. So we'll take that up at a later time.
Madam Chair, I am aware of that letter, and I have instructed them to communicate with the Board of Medicine. I'm carrying this bill on the Board of Medicine's behalf, and I won't change any aspects of it unless they agree with those. So you can ask Ms. Stoven about that in the next few minutes.
Thank you. Senator Geisler, if we can try to find out some way how many other states recognize through a licensure program certified medical assistance, that would be helpful if there's any information you can provide us. In addition, we will ask the questions from Senator Stephen and Senator Olson as we go forward. I'm wondering, in the process, will the board actually approve the final licensure of any doctor that's coming into our state? The background work is done by a delegated representative, the executive director, or as stated earlier. After that happens, will the board officially approve a list of physicians to practice in our state?
Madam Chair, again, for clarification, that would be a question for Ms. Stovern. Okay. However, I will tell you, as I mentioned earlier, this procedure of delegating routine, clean license applications to an executive administrator has been in effect for about 15 to 20 years by another major licensing board. Frankly, the Board of Nursing has been doing this for 15 to 20 years. It works very well. These are routine, clean applications. The ones that have questions are held back, and the Board of Medicine reviews those individually at their quarterly meetings.
So the answer is that a clean application would not go before the board, only those that had some indication that needed further conversation.
Madam Chair, it's up to the Board of Medicine how they want to review the ones that the executive administrator have approved. I have not prescribed that in the bill.
Thank you. With that, there is some invited testimony. Thank you, Senator Geisler. Thank you, Ms. Conway. I'd like to invite Fred Parody. Fred, if you could comment from the administration's perspective. Mr. Parody is the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. Deputy Commissioner Parody, welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Fred Parody. I'm Deputy Commissioner in Commerce. I want to begin this morning by expressing our appreciation to Senator Geisler for her longstanding commitment to these issues and particularly for her professional insight into them. It's been most helpful. This is a bill that the governor and the department wholeheartedly support. The workload of the medical board has dramatically increased due to telemedicine legislation. You heard reference to that earlier. In 2015, the backlog reached approximately 6 months in application processing time due to the volume of applications received. As many of you know, fielding complaints from applicants in medical facilities can be time-consuming. Alaska's demand for healthcare professionals has only increased since then. In FY217, the division processed 22% more medical licenses and 31% more nursing licenses than in FY16. And already in FY18, we have received fiscal year to date more licenses than we received in the previous fiscal year in its entirety. So basically in 8 months, we've already seen 12 months in volume. Through the budget process and recent legislation, we've been able to devote more staff to these programs. But in addition, we at DCCED initiated a strategic planning initiative, which I'm excited to share with you today. This is the good work of government that goes on day to day by our dedicated staff. As we entered that planning process, streamlining the application process for the healthcare professions emerged as our department's number one priority. So we initiated in this process a comprehensive examination of the application process by a team that does the work day to day. It was a great, I'll use the word joy, to watch that team go to work. We had a facilitator for their work. We did the classic whiteboard process where we whiteboarded out every step of the process, and we identified what were called rubs. Where's the friction? What is slowing us down, and where is it? And we identified 27 rubs. Next, we evaluated each of those problems to determine whether the issue served a public safety purpose, met a public safety need, or whether the process was simply outdated or even obsolete. Could it be simplified? Could it be streamlined? And we initiated a three-prong approach to implementing solutions to streamline this licensure process. And the three buckets that we divided those rubs into essentially were small changes through board regulations is bucket one. The Board of Medicine has proactively implemented those changes to their regulations, and they're already underway. An example of that kind of rub is we had a board regulation that required a notary to put their stamp on the photo of the applicant. There's several problems with that. The notary is not really able to attest that that person is the person in the application. They're just attesting that that person is standing in front of them when they put the stamp on it, and notaries are trained to not put their stamp onto the heart of documents and pictures, etc. So it really served no purpose, didn't meet a public safety need, and wasn't effective. But if you were absent that notary stamp and you're in the application process, it kicks your application back out to make sure that it gets done. The second bucket of problems, and this is where I'm most excited this morning, because is the IT, improvements in technology. How can we make this process flow better? We've had the ability to accept online renewal applications, but not online new applications. And we, at 10:30 this morning, the team gets its first live look at the IT group's new process to both, it streamlines it and brings it both for renewal and for new applications. And there are exciting things in there. For example, there is, as with your PFD, if you're rolling through the application online and you fail to answer a question, you can't proceed. You have to meet each step of the way, answer each question. For reference for you, it's common in these applications for incomplete rates to complete applications are normally less than 10%. So setting the process up to bring complete applications in the gate to begin with is a primary way to make this work better. We also, and this is inspiration, one of our deputy directors had as she was watching a television commercial, but we're going to have a feature similar to a Domino's pizza tracker where you can monitor our progress with your application from the website, from the online application. So the new applications for licensure can be submitted electronically through the MyAlaska platform. This will result in greater efficiencies and more effective communication amongst our staff, our applicants, and the healthcare facilities who we're all trying to serve, the public. We are in the testing phase of that enhancement, and again, the first live rollout to the team is this morning at 10:30. The third bucket of improvements is what's before you now. It is changes to statute that will allow us to more effectively administer these programs. And so the last requirement of the streamlining project is a change in statutes that would improve license processing times while still ensuring public safety, which is, of course, the ultimate goal. The minor change in this bill will allow the medical board to grant additional authority to the executive administrator to issue medical licenses to applicants that meet the strictest guidelines and allow further delegation to supervisors to expedite and issue temporary licenses. As an aside, this bill also closes the loop to allow delegation to CMPs regarding PDMP, but that's not the core issue of the streamlining process. So your support of this bill is the next step in ensuring Alaska's healthcare facilities are able to keep their doors open, fully staffed, and able to serve the public in a timely fashion. And we support the bill wholeheartedly. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Are there questions from committee members? Deputy Commissioner, thank you for testifying before Senate Finance today. I'd like to move off net to Deborah Stovern, the Executive Director of the State Medical Board. Deborah, do you have comments for the committee's consideration? You did hear two different questions or several questions from Senate Finance. If you could incorporate those into your comments, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Deborah Stovern. I am with the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing, and as stated, I am the Executive Administrator for the State Medical Board. I do have a couple of things, a couple of comments that may clarify some of the questions that have come up in the prior committee and this committee. First of all, currently, under current statute, only the board is authorized to grant licenses. They also have the authority to delegate to me the authority to approve applications for temporary permits, locum tenens permits, courtesy licenses, and resident permits. Since the board only meets four times each year, the regular temporary permit allows an applicant with a complete file to practice until the next board meeting when their file will be considered by the board for approval of their permanent license. A temporary permit is time limited to 6 months and cannot be extended. As part of the streamlining project that Deputy Commissioner Parity commented on, the board has taken a number of actions to improve their application processing, including some in-office efficiencies and changes to application requirements. They've also adopted some changes to include participation in programs offered by the Federation of State Medical Boards, such as the Federation's Credentials Verification Service and their online uniform application process. They've also adopted regulations for an expedited temporary permit, which would allow a temporary permit to be issued for a clean application once the application, credentials, and clearance documents have been received, but they still may be lacking some of the additional required documents. We're just in the process of implementing that expedited temporary permit and haven't really used it yet. The regulations just recently became final. However, I anticipate once this legislation passes, the way the process would work is the board would continue to delegate the approval authority to the executive secretary as well as to delegate approval authority to the board's licensing supervisor, for the issuance of these expedited temporary permits and other clean types of temporary permits like the locum tenens, the courtesy license, and the resident permit that I commented on. Any other file would be referred to the executive secretary to handle as per our current procedures, which may include a board review or full board interview or things like that as appropriate. So once an expedited file becomes complete, that file would be referred to the executive secretary for approval of the permanent license. And again, any application with derogatory or adverse information or any discrepancies or with any questions or concerns would require a board review for approval of temporary and or a permanent license as appropriate. And this delegation under this legislation currently requires and would continue to require specific delegation by the board on an annual basis. So the board could choose to implement it or not. They could choose to implement some of it and not others of it, other parts of it. They could choose to delegate only to the executive secretary. They could continue to delegate only temporary permits. It would be up to the board based on their confidence in staffing. They could choose to see a list of the approved permanent licenses that were issued by the executive secretary at each meeting to ratify them if that's what they wanted to see. So, again, it's all in the board's hands how they want to handle this authority to delegate. I think there was also a question about CME, continuing medical education for the new class of licenses for certified medical assistants, and I don't know what the board will choose to do. I can state that for physician assistants, the licensing program there requires a physician assistant to maintain their national certification with the national certifying body. To maintain that national certification, they're required to complete continuing medical education. I would anticipate that the board may do something similar with certified medical assistants.
Senator Olson, do you have a follow-up on that?
No, I don't, Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens, you had a question. I just want to make sure that's covered. Then we'll come back to you, Ms. Stover.
Yes, thank you. And you did answer the question on 6 months being the longest time a temporary license could be held. I guess just looking at the bigger picture, Deborah, you know, our concern has to be with a patient, has to be with the people who are being served by these people who had a temporary license. Can you guarantee us that no one would be given a temporary license who truly did not have the medical background that they should have?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator, the way it currently works, the temporary permits are issued based on a checklist that is developed by the board that delineates all of the requirements for licensure and provides a means for the processing of that application so that we can be assured that all of those requirements are met and all the credentials are in place before a temporary permit is issued. And the board would be tasked with further developing that checklist for this enhanced process.
Senator Stevens, follow up.
Well, thank you. I know this may be a little paranoid, but you know, always hear stories of people without the proper training, not in Alaska that I know of, but practicing without the proper licenses, and it's not just in medicine, it's other fields. So just want to be absolutely assured that the public is safe here. A temporary license is well vetted, and we are absolutely sure that this person is well-trained and up to the job.
Thank you, Senator Olson, followed by Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to comment on the concern that Senator Stevens has, is that we're very concerned about public safety and the public's being well-served by what's going on. But right now, what I've seen, especially with the health corporations and they're trying to fill sites, trying to fill physician positions out in rural Alaska, is that a disservice has actually happened because of the lack of streamlining, in that you can't get people out there that have clean licenses, and we can't guarantee that nothing bad will ever happen. I mean, only God can do that, and we don't put ourselves in positions like that. And so I applaud her Senator Giesel coming forward with this bill, because when I was on the medical board, I thought it was cumbersome then. But it's even more cumbersome now as you look at some of these concerns that people have, and they're trying to answer them all. But you need some way of making it so that there's not such a backlog for especially people that are having a hard time filling those positions.
Senator Olson, could you put on the record your status as a physician? I think that for the general public, I'll ask Senator Giesel to do the same. We really do depend on Alaska is a representative democracy, and we are a constitution that allows working people to be representatives of the people in Alaska. And we have two individuals that are professionals in the medical community to offer us advice and guidance as we go forward with some of these important issues for Alaska. And I certainly don't want to put your medical license, Dr. Olson, in jeopardy by stating something on the record is something you don't want to do. But the general public may not understand that we do have two licensed professionals in this room today, at a minimum, to provide us advice or at least direction on their perspective of how this licensing would affect our medical community.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity. I certainly have been a medical doctor and was first licensed in 1984, practiced medicine out in rural Alaska throughout my medical career, and was on the medical board in 1995 and served until I was elected to this office and had to give that position up on the medical board. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for providing that valuable perspective for all Alaska. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question for Ms. Stoburn, and if Senator Olson wants to bring God into this, I worry that the fiscal note will increase dramatically. So, but back to the question. Foundation Health Partners in their letter talked about losing physician candidates because of the amount of time it takes. Just in speaking to Senator McKinnon's concern, just do you today during the board meetings have sort of a double track that the physicians that have all the boxes are checked, everything's ready to go, where it's just a very simple approval process, and then the other applications that might be a little bit more problematic? Because my understanding on the bill is that the executive would just simply be able to approve those that have clearly have no issues, therefore not reducing or changing the credibility or credential requirements whatsoever. Is that your vision of how this bill would work?
Through the chair, Senator, yes. Right now, as I stated, the board has to review and approve all applications for permanent licensure. They are given that checklist that I mentioned where I've ticked off all the items with a little yellow highlighter when I approve the temporary permit, and they rely on that heavily to review those clean applications and approve them, and they do spend their time scrutinizing the applications that have maybe some adverse information or discrepancies or things like that. But I don't want to say they rubber stamp it, but they do rely on the fact that I have already reviewed and confirmed the credentials and approved a temporary permit when they are issuing their approval of the permanent license.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my I share the same concern that we've heard around here. We certainly don't want to reduce the requirements just for public safety and health issues. But just the way I'm understanding this bill is really nothing changes on the actual requirements to practice as a physician in the state of Alaska.
Ms. Stover and Senator Machicki, I believe, is making a request to confirm or deny that there is any changes to the requirements to get licensure in the state of Alaska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is my understanding that is a correct statement.
Thank you. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you help us understand the backlog of 290 applications? How old are those? Are there some that are 6 months, some that are a year, 5 years? I'm sure that's not true, but how long? Could you give us an age on those backlog applications?
Through the chair, Senator, we're not, I wouldn't characterize us as having a huge backlog at this point. We are still struggling with a lot of applications, and as Deputy Commissioner Parity mentioned, that number of applications received increases by some 20% or more every year. In addition to that initial influx, huge influx of telemedicine applications after that legislation passed. But as we implement these efficiencies and streamlining processes, we're able to reduce that time significantly that it takes to receive a license or even get the application processed. Many times, I want to defend my staff, many times an application takes time due to an applicant or other organizations delaying getting required documents to us, credential documents to us. However, anywhere we can make efficiencies and changes to streamline the process, it helps. And it helps to make better use of our limited staff in processing these large numbers of applications that we receive. I would say timeline Once we receive an application in the office, our staff will respond to the applicant with a status letter. Our division standard is a week to 10 days. We're hard-pressed to meet that, but it's not much farther out than that. Once an application is complete, meaning all of the documents and credentials required to qualify for a license are in the office, the timeline for building that file and reviewing it for issuance of a temporary permit is within anywhere from a week to 3 weeks, and again, depending on if there is adverse information or any discrepancies, obviously take a little bit longer than that. But there's so many moving parts and pieces that all we can do really is give averages for timelines for the application process. And any backlogs currently are related to missing credentials and documents on the file.
Senator Stevens, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what I'm hearing from you is that an extension of 6 months pretty much will take care of the backlog that you're facing, that most of the it's not like most of the applicants are going to be taken care of, processed within a six-month period.
Through the chair, Senator, yes, I would anticipate that to be very true.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Ms. Stover, can you stay online so that we can open the public hearing and then go into debating the bill maybe after we close the public hearing?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'd like to open the public hearing on SB 108, an act relating to the state medical board. I'd like to go to Fairbanks first, Dr. Danny Robinetti.
Hello, good morning, everyone. This is Danny Robinette. I'm a physician. I've been practicing in Alaska for a little over 30 years, 26 years in Fairbanks. Currently, I'm the chief medical officer for Foundation Health Partners, including Fairbanks Memorial Hospital and Denali Center. I'll try to be brief and hit the high points. I certainly agree with concerns about maintaining the integrity and rigor of the licensing process. None of us want to see physicians with cloudy or bad credentials show up in our state taking care of our patients. And so we encourage keeping the diligent process intact and not changing the standards. However, I think there is room for the factors in the bill that would help streamline the timeline. While the averages may not be too long, certainly in Fairbanks, we've lost at least three physician candidates because they got a license faster in another state and took another position in the past 2 years, and that's an expensive process for us. I have one young man who grew up in Fairbanks, trained through the WAMI program for medical school and did his surgery training in Gunderson in Wisconsin, who came up and took almost 8 months to get his license, again, a clean license. So we would encourage and support streamlining that process for clean candidates. Obviously, those applications that have significant issues bear closer scrutiny, just as we would scrutinize them ourselves before granting privileges here in our facility. And we support the bill that Senator Gazelle has introduced. I'd also like to take a brief opportunity to thank Senator Bishop on the committee for his service to Interior Alaska, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So back to the issue we were originally talking about, a six-month extension doesn't much help your doctor who took 8 months to get his licensure. So can you help tell us how this helps?
I think in general what we're seeing is while the averages may not be as long, some cases because of the backlog do get extended longer than the average process. And so we think if we can grant this authority to the director, it saves waiting for the next board meeting for a clean candidate. And that could be supposing the application gets complete, just after the board meeting, that might be delay of several weeks for that particular individual.
Senator Stevens, follow up.
No, I think I understand. Thank you, Doctor. So as I understand it, the individual you were talking about may have been given a six-month extension, but at the end of that 6 months, if his file was not complete, he would have been denied the opportunity to keep working in Alaska. Is that true?
It is true. Fortunately, in that particular case, he was completing his surgery training and started the process early enough that it didn't really delay his starting to work. But it's just an example of one that took a little longer than the normal process.
Thank you, Dr. Robinette.
Thank you, Dr. Robinette. Senator Bishop.
Hey, thank you for your comments today and enlightening on the process. Doctor, are you at liberty to tell us what it cost the hospital foundation to vet a doctor, and then because of our process, he gets a license and hired in another location? What's the number on your expense to vet that individual?
Well, for example, the cardiology position, because we're two positions short at the time, and now we've since filled one, so we're only one short, we're hiring temporary doctors to staff so that the one guy doesn't have to work all the time. So including that cost in that, it's actually in the several hundred thousand dollar range. If you look just at the cost of recruiting an individual physician, the time spent processing applications, the time having them come up for interviews, and the money, that's probably on the average of somewhere between $30,000 and $50,000 all told. So it's not an insignificant expense.
Senator Bishop, follow up.
Thank you. And I have a comment I want to make here, because I don't have Dr. Olson's experience or Senator Giesel's experience and whatnot, but I'm just going off of common sense here. But so the hospital obviously spends a lot of time vetting this individual themselves, plus they've got to go through the board process, correct? So it's almost like a double vetting. So
absolutely correct. Again, I think we should do that, and I don't want to change any of that, but anything we can do to streamline it would be great.
So that's my point. So, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Dr. Robinette, you are supportive of the bill that's before Senate Finance?
Yes, I am.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on the sponsor substitute for Senate Bill number 108, version U? Anyone off net or online? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. We did have Janie McCullough. Did you want to testify? I have you down for questions. If not, then I'd like to direct the committee's attention to the fiscal note. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 108, fiscal note, Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, the appropriation is corporations, businesses, and professional licensing. The OMB component number is 2360, fiscal year 19. In the first year, it's $252,000. In the out years, it's $225.3. Brief analysis includes one full-time record and licensing supervisor is needed to implement this program. Currently, there's one existing records and licensing and supervisor is spread around numerous programs. Only part of that position's time is dedicated to the program. As a result of the addition of the certified medical assistant license type, the workload related to the program supports a dedicated records and licensing supervisor. Third time I got it perfect. If the bill passes, the following expenses will be incurred. Personal services line, $177,000, two full-time positions, travel, 1.5, services 10,000, annual investigations 5,000, regulations 4.5, 30,000 annual core and services and allocated cost. Supplies the first year for setup is 22,000, 2.5 for postage, and 1,000 for office supplies. And as usual and customary, professional licensing programs within the division are funded by receipt supported services 1156, and it's DGF funds. So licensing fees for each occupation are set per AS08 01 065. So the total amount of revenue collected approximately equals the occupation's actual regulatory cost.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Are there questions on the fiscal note? Seeing and hearing none, I'd like to go back to Deborah Stovern. Deborah, are you still online?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Could you make a comment regarding the American Association of Medical Assistants and their reference to medical assistants being certified versus Alaska's system that uses CMA, Certified Medical Assistants? Have you spoken with the board? Do you have comments for our consideration?
Madam Chair, I only recently became aware of that inquiry, and the board has not considered it. I did research their note that the Washington State recognizes or licenses their certified medical assistants as a medical assistant dash certified. I don't know. I'm not an attorney, so I couldn't tell you if the language of the bill would support the board issuing a license with that designation or if it would need to be a license that said certified medical assistant. I don't know much more than that.
Thank you very much. Senator Giesel, could you come to the microphone? The letter that I'm referencing is available online and posted under Senate Finance for those that are interested. It's dated February 26, 2018. It's addressed to Senator Giesel. The committee's in possession of that. It's from Donald A., and his last name is spelled B-A-L-A-S-A. He is legal counsel and CEO of AAMA, which is American Association of Medical Assistants. So just for reference. Senator Giesel, I asked Senator Olson to put his credentials on the record for at least providing the legislature an understanding of the document and perspectives before us. I know that you're professionally licensed in the state of Alaska. Could you put your credentials on the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have been a registered nurse in Alaska since 1974, an advanced nurse practitioner since the year 2000. I served on the Board of Nursing from 2002 to 2010. Five of those years, I served as the Board of Nursing Chair.
Thank you very much. Do you have any comments, or we can certainly wait for those comments later on the letter that we just received?
Madam Chair, thank you for bringing that up again. You will notice on the letter, the signatories at the end have a credential after their name that says CMA. This was their assertion that it should be MA-C was something completely new that appeared quite recently. Madam Chair, it is a trivial matter, and the bill has critically urgent issues in it. So to hold this up for that one particular thing, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, but the folks that even signed the letter use CMA as their credential.
Thank you for those comments, Senator Giesel. With that, any other questions for Senator Giesel? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Giesel, there's two aspects to this bill that I see. One has to do with the CMA issue that is, and the other has to do with the medical licensing of people that are going to practice. Have you gotten any letters of support or letters of opposition from some of the physician groups, especially specifically things like asthma, the Alaska State Medical Association, or any other physician organization that's out there?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I have not received any support letters from the Alaska State Medical Association or the specialty association, the Association of Physicians and Surgeons. But at the same time, I've received no opposition. I will remind you that the Board of Medicine themselves wrote this bill. Of course, legal corrected it into legalese, but essentially asked for these particular aspects. I did want to, Madam Chair, with your permission, point out something that might have been lost in the communication and would possibly address some of Senator Stevens' issues. Ms. Stovern pointed out that currently in place right now and has been for a considerable period of time is her authorization to approve clean temporary permits. A temporary permit is not new in the state of Alaska for either medicine or nursing. In fact, locum tenens permits are also currently approved by the Executive Secretary of the Board of Medicine. This is not a new phenomena, Madam Chair.
Thank you for those comments. With that, we'll be setting aside SB 108. Amendments are due tomorrow, Wednesday at 5 p.m. I'd like to direct the committee's attention to SB 105. We have a CS before us for SB 105 from Labor and Commerce. It's /J. It's an act relating to the licensure of marital and family therapists, relating to professional liability insurance for marital and family therapists, relating to medical assistance for marital and family therapy services, and providing for an effective date. I'd like to invite Senator Wilson and his staff, Gary Zepp, to the microphone to introduce the bill. Welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is David Wilson, Senator for District D. Thank you for hearing this bill, Senate Bill 105, the Marital Family Therapy Licenses Services, as an act related to the licensure of the marital family therapists relating to professional liability insurance and for marital family therapists relating to medical assistance, marital family services, and providing for effective date. If enacted, this would allow the licensed marital family therapists in the state to list the independent licensed practitioners and to address the shortage of Medicaid eligible providers of behavioral health providers in the state of Alaska, to afford more options for beneficiaries and to increase access to care. We emailed the members of the committee on providing the link to the behavioral health assessment report, which was updated in 2016, indicates approximately 20% of Alaskans' adult population, which is about 145,000 adults, need mental or behavioral health services. However, 19% or 27,782 of those folks that are in need of mental health services from funding from Alaska Medicaid or Behavioral Health Fund. No data exists to determine whether the remaining 81% of received mental health services are paid for or did not receive those services. Also, the Alaska 2015-16 Primary Care Needs Assessment Report indicates that there's approximately about 85 licensed psychiatrists. And that number may seem high in Alaska, but licensing does not mean practicing. Research compiled by the Arctic Mental Health Working Group states that the two studies that have compared the number of psychiatrists in Alaska versus those in the lower 48. The national average indicates that Alaska needs additional 106 to 184 additional psychiatrists per 100,000 adults to meet those national averages. That may seem high, but it's where our national trend is at. Currently, the marital family licenses, or the MFTs, are allowed to provide services in community health clinics or physician mental health clinics, which effectively limits the number of willing providers to cover that mental health care arena. SB 105 would expand the mental health assistance reimbursement services to cover those services provided by the marital licensed therapist. Specifically, SB 105 designates the licensed marital family therapist as providers eligible to render and bill for Medicaid services funded by as an independent practitioner under the Alaska State Statute 47.07.030B. clarifies supervisionary requirements for the marital license therapist licenses, requires a marriage and family therapist license to carry liability insurance for regulatory investigative fees of at least $30,000. And in 2016, the Board of Marital Licensed Family Therapists unanimously recommended the statute changes contained in the Senate Bill 105. In general, the statute defines the practice of marital family therapy as a diagnosis and treatment for mental and emotional disorders as referenced in the Standard Diagnostic Numerical for Marital and Family Therapy, whether cognitive, affective, or behavioral in the context of human relationships, particularly in the marital and family systems. The marital and family therapy involves a professional application for the assessments and treatments of psychotherapeutic services to individuals, couples, and families for the purposes of treating diagnosis for emotional and mental disorders. As some of the members of this committee may have gone through with Senate Bill 74 a few years ago, we understand these recommendations and changes were discussed during that passage of SB 74, but however they were not included in the final version of that bill. The increased number of providers available for the behavioral health delivery services were stated among those goals of SB 74. Recently, the end of January of 31st, the state of Alaska Department of Behavioral Health Services, through the Department of Health Services, submitted a Medicaid waiver 1115 to help with their behavioral health demonstration application project. Stated several times within this project are goals of expansion of treatment of capacity and improved access to healthcare behavioral health services. This is one of those major issues that we all know Alaska is way under underfunded in behavioral health services, can't provide the number of behavioral health providers in the state of Alaska, as we'll hear from several folks, I believe, that are online to testify on the difficulty of recruitment of licensed providers that can bill for their agencies. The difference between hiring a different licensure provider versus a licensed mental health therapist can range anywhere from $60,000 to $80,000 per person just for the hiring costs for them. And the time frame can range a shorter time frame from 46 months versus up to a year plus for the hiring of these individuals. With that.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. Are there questions from the sponsor? With that, Mr. Zepp, could you walk us through a sectional of what the bill does?
Madam Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Gary Zepp, staff to Senator David Wilson. Before I begin, did you want me to go over the summary of changes for Senate Bill 105 from version D to version J?
No, we have version J in front of us. If you could just go over what J does.
Sections 1 and 2 of the bill impact AS 08.63, which is the marital and family therapy, and the subsections 08.63-100, qualifications for license to practice, and 08.63.120, which is authorized supervisors. Section 1 on page 2, lines 17 through 25, adds a supervision requirement for marital and family therapists and clarifies that the required 1,500 hours of clinical contact must include 100 hours of individual supervision and 100 hours of group supervision, and that may be conducted by one or more supervisors. Section 1 continues on page 2, lines 29 through 31, and it requires not less than $30,000 in professional liability coverage for the applicant's regulatory investigation fees in the state. Section 2, page 3, lines 2 through 18, impact the authorized supervisor section of the statutes, and it expands the group supervision to include professional counselors, marital and family therapists, physicians who are licensed as psychiatrists, an advanced practice registered nurse who is authorized by the Board of Nursing to practice as an adult or family psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner, a psychologist, and a social worker. Sections 3, 4, and 5 impact AS 47.07, which is the medical assistance for needy persons, and the subsection AS 47.07.030, which is the medical services to be provided. Section 3 on page 3, line 31, adds marital and family therapy services to the list of optional services available through the Department of Health and Social Services under this subsection. Section 4 on page 4, lines 8 through 16, also impact medical services to be provided, and it adds a new paragraph G to AS 47.70.030 to clarify that the term direct supervision may be performed by one or more psychiatrists as long as that supervision takes place on the premises of the clinic 30% of the time that the clinic is open. Section 5, on page 4, lines 17 through 31, and continuing on page 5, line 1, impacts the medical services to be provided, adds a new subsection H to 47.70.030 that allows the department to reimburse a mental health physician clinic for services provided by a psychiatrist or an individual who works under a psychiatrist and is licensed to practice as a professional counselor, a marital and family therapist, a physician assistant, an advanced practice registered nurse who is authorized by the Board of Nursing to practice as an adult or family psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner, a psychologist associate, and a clinical social worker. Section 6 on page 5, lines 2 through 7, amends the uncodified law to authorize the Department of Health and Social Services and the Board of Marital and Family Therapy to adopt regulations to implement the changes of this act.
Thank you, Mr. Zepp. Are there questions on the structure of the bill? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hearing this in context with the prior discussion we had on medical practitioners, can you tell me the time it takes to get licensed under this for marital and family issues? The time it takes for that licensure, is there a backlog, and is there such a thing as a temporary licensure?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, we have a couple of folks online, probably Ken McCarthy, one of the licensed marital therapy board members, probably could answer that, or one of the other providers that are on the phone about the timeline of how long it takes to get licensed. My understanding for this bill is more of not to issue the temporary license, but to try to expand the scope of qualified individuals who already are currently doing the services now to be able to be reimbursed through the Medicaid system for this.
Senator
Lennon-Hoff. Thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly understand that and appreciate it, but I'm just assuming we're not facing the same problems here that we're facing with medical practitioners, and it would be nice to be assured of that.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Senator Wilson, did you have an additional comment?
No, not this time.
Thank you. We have quite a bit of invited testimony, so I'm going to open the public testimony for the CS for Senate Bill number 105 and start with invited testimony. So the public hearing is open. I'd like to go first to Randall Burns. We do have a letter from Mr. Burns. Randall, could you join us at the microphone? Senator Von Imhoff, I'm sorry, did you have a question?
Just on Section 1?
Certainly, Senator Von Imhoff.
Okay. The question that I have is at the very last sentence on Section 1 in the sectional, requires that an applicant for a license to practice must have professional liability insurance, including coverage for at least $30,000. I'm assuming that he or she requires or obtains that insurance after his training is over. His or her training is over. It's not during the, what's the catch-22? You have to get insurance while you're training. You get insurance when you're finished training.
Senator Wilson. Please stay at the table. Thank you.
The insurance piece is to cover sort of the investigative and regulatory issues after their license. So this would be after their license that they would have obtained this insurance.
Thank you. With that, we are in public testimony. Mr. Burns, welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Randall Burns. I'm the director of the Division of Behavioral Health, for the Department of Health and Social Services. We are in support of this legislation, and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Von Imhoff.
Yes, so section, thank you, Madam Chair. OK, Okay, Section 4, it says direct supervision must mean that one or more psychiatrists are on the premises of a mental health physician clinic to provide services relating to mental health at least 30% of the time that the clinic is opened. Now, when I'm picturing maybe in rural Alaska in a village or a small community, are there often psychiatrists in these areas, or 30% of the time, and is 30% of the time being open a day, a week, a month? So there could be like a week that a psychiatrist is on site, and that's 30% of the time for the whole month that we're counting, or are there times where a psychiatrist could be available via telemedicine, so he's not on the, but it says on the premises. And so I guess what I'm worried about is by opening the opportunity for family counselor to be behavioral health therapist, which I think is a great idea to open up opportunities in rural Alaska, how can you get a psychiatrist on site 30% of the time?
Madam Chair, Representative, sorry, Senator Van Amoff, this is actually language from our current regulations, and it was essentially taken from our existing regulations and placed in statute. And this is the current rules guiding a physician clinics. However, we are certainly in support of changing that if that was the desire of the sponsor or of the committee. We ourselves are working on regulations that would essentially reduce this entirely and simply make it comport with what we require of community behavioral health centers, which is simply that they have a physician who is has an agreement with the clinic for the supervision of that clinic. So we also agree that the 30%, we did get approval from the AG's office to essentially say that the 30%, as our current regulations provide, could be made up by more than one. So if a physician's clinic had two psychiatrists, then it would be, they could split it between them however they wanted to do that. We also think that's awkward, and at this point in time, thank you, at this point in time, we really do believe that given our desire for access, that we should essentially change the way in which we approach this. We considered it, still retain some concerns about what opening it up to a total reduction of the need for direct on-site supervision. The original goal here was to make sure that these mental health physician clinics were, in fact, opened up by psychiatrists, not just by physicians, and that they were, in fact, providing some oversight so that the quality of the mental health treatment was assured. I do think at this point in time that the 30% is probably creating roadblocks for, as you point out, for instance, the supervision in rural Alaska. However, I would point out also that we do remain somewhat concerned. We are certainly aware of physician clinics, psychiatrists, who are interested in opening clinics in other locations, which is great, but we are also, I think, legitimately concerned about the oversight of the operations of those clinics. But we don't feel, given that for all these years we've only required an agreement in writing between the physician and a mental health clinic, that we could really justify at this point in time creating a significant difference between the physician mental health clinic and a community behavioral health clinic. And for that reason, actually, we are in ourselves, if this changes, goes this forward, it would create some awkwardness for us because we would ourselves are considering changing our regulation with different language.
Well,
brief at ease. We're back in the record. Senator Von Hemhoff.
No further questions. Thank you.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I realize we're under a time constraint here, but maybe Mr. Burns could get back to us on my earlier question, the time it takes for a licensure. Is there such a thing as a temporary license, and is there a backlog? You mentioned roadblocks. You don't need to answer that now, but just
back to me. Through the Chair, Senator Stevens, that really should be questions for the Department of Commerce. I don't have that kind of information.
Thank you for joining Senate Finance today. The next person under invited testimony is Dorothea Goddard Aguirre, and please correct your name if I have just correct your name for the record. I do not see Dorothea online. The next person waiting to testify is Karen Cunningham. Karen, are you there?
Hi, good morning. This is Karen Cunningham. Thank you so much for having me. It's really, truly an honor to get a chance to speak with you. I'm watching you guys on screen, and there's a bit of a lag, so I hope you can hear me. I am Vice President of the Marriage and Family Therapy Board. There is a associate licensure. There's an application for board approval before anybody can get an associate license, and there's about a minimum of a two-year supervision period. That's what this part of this bill is seeking to make that supervision period a little bit more accessible for people who want to be marriage and family therapists. Unfortunately, the board has not had a chance to meet yet, so I can't give kind of an official statement of the board. But I would be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Cunningham. Senator Stevens, would you like to direct that question to Ms. Cunningham?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And again, we can get back to me later if you'd like to. But concerned about the time it takes for licensure, are the temporary licenses provided? Is there a backlog? Are there roadblocks, as Mr. Burns had mentioned? Maybe you could respond to that or let me know later.
Ms. Cunningham, could you respond to that now?
Oh, sure. I'd be able to at least tackle most of it. There's an application for associate licensure. That needs to be submitted and approved by the board. Before that application can even be submitted, the applicant needs to have a supervision plan laid out for the board to approve. Currently, we have 18 approved supervisors in the state of Alaska. So one big obstacle to bringing more MSPs into the field is that they can't even submit an application for associate licensure until they've got a supervision plan.
Senator Stevens, follow-up.
No, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Cunningham, for those comments. The next person waiting to testify, well, the next person invited by the sponsor was Nicole Jenkins. I don't see Nicole online. Leon Weber, I do not see Leon Weber online. Joan Young, I do not see Joan Young online. Ken McCarty, if you could identify yourself for the record and then please proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, this is Ken McCarty from Eagle River.
Welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you. What would you like me to address?
Do you have comments for the committee to consider on SB 105?
Sure. Let me give you some reference. I was on the regulatory board for 6 years, ended that term last March. President of the Alaska Association of Marriage and Family Therapists for 3 years, so I'm past president. Director of Discovery Cove Counseling, which is in Eagle River, and Kodiak, and then we have operations or clients all over the state. That the need for marriage family therapists is, you know, to be included is crucial. There's quite a few therapists throughout the state, which some agencies that are community health clinics already bill for those services. But for private entities, they're no longer acknowledged. If they leave an agency, they're no longer acknowledged for Medicaid. So So this will fix that issue. As an example, just for Discovery Cove, we have 160 people that want to get off of opiates, and we cannot serve them except for the psychiatrist, but that would be half the treatment program, so we're not going to even serve them at all. It's like going into a position and going to the hospital with a broken leg and a lacerated, you know, face, and you say, well, we can fix the face, but we can't deal with the leg because, and that's where it's at right now. So this will fix that issue there. I applaud Mr. Burns and the department in favor of this bill. I, along with the senator, am concerned about language that isolates psychiatrists to be on the premise. Our psychiatrist, we actually had at 1.2 with a physician, so three physicians on staff. The language, the way that the Department of Behavioral Health interpreted things at that point was the regulation said that a psychiatrist, so people were interpreting that only one of the psychiatrists could be acknowledged, the rest could not. We were well over the 30%, but we weren't even acknowledged at that point. So this statute thing is not to define that, but I think it would be very concerning if the definition of a psychiatrist on premise, that would really isolate telemedicine ability. And as we are looking at opportunities to fly into villages, but the psychiatrist can't do that in the sense that I've had our psychiatrist in Kodiak get stuck there and couldn't make it to Nome to see the clients that they have up there. So it's great that we have SB 74 and telemedicine. And answering the question regarding associates or people that are, let's not talk about associates, let's talk about licensed people that are trying to get licensed in Alaska. They're coming from another state. Reciprocity is acknowledged by the Marriage Family Therapist Board. That for my experience on the board, I tried to expedite that process rather than having to wait to a board meeting, that if all the documents were there, the examiner presented it to the board through email and said this is gain approval, then the board had the ability to vote rather than waiting for a next board meeting, but vote for those individual people so they could expedite the process to serve in Alaska. With that, we didn't have to do the temporary license issue there. Regarding associates, that associates have 4 years to get their license, and in that time that they currently have to do 100 hours of supervision individually and 100 hours of supervision for group. And that's caused a problem where associates are scattered throughout Alaska. Most of the super are in Anchorage, maybe Fairbanks, but we have people out in Casa View or Barrow that there is no supervisor out there. So they do their 100 hours of individual, and they do their their hours of clinical time, but they lack the 100 hours of group, and so this will fix that issue there because there's always someone that's a supervisor at the site under a different license. The issue for liability insurance is we've experienced, about 20 years ago, there was an incident where someone had done something wrong and cost the board a lot of money in investigation fees. And this is not just for our board, but other boards, but speaking on behalf or not on behalf, but historically of the Marriage Family Therapist Board. So this discussion of putting in a liability insurance so that it covers investigation fees so that it doesn't cost a great, it doesn't
Mr. McCarty.
Create an inconvenience.
Mr.
So
McCarty?
That's what that's about. And I support that.
Mr. McCarty, are you in support of Senate Bill 105? Your time is up.
Yes. Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. Is there a closing thought that you'd like to provide for the committee to consider?
No, just what I just shared. Very much support the bill.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from committee members? Thank you, Mr. McCarty. I'd like to invite Elizabeth Ripley as well as Robin Menard to the microphones. We'll start with Elizabeth Ripley here in Juneau. Your testimony will be limited to 3 minutes. If you could please proceed.
Senator McKinnon, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Elizabeth Ripley. I serve as the CEO of the Mat-Su Health Foundation. Mat-Su Health Foundation is a public charity which shares ownership in the Mat-Su Regional Medical Center, and we invest our share of the profits back into the community in order to measurably improve the health of our population. I'm testifying today in support of SB 105, which will allow marriage and family therapists to bill Medicaid for their services. There are critical pieces missing in Alaska's continuum of care for mental health and substance use disorders. And sadly, our main paths to treatment are the jails and emergency department. By example, the Mat-Su Regional Emergency Department is the number one portal in Mat-Su for people experiencing a behavioral health crisis in terms of both volume and cost, even though we don't provide behavioral health services. In 2016, 3,443 patients with behavioral health diagnosis went to the Mat-Su Regional Emergency Department. Their charges totaled $43.8 million, and that's not counting the additional cost in millions more for estimated law enforcement, 911 dispatch, and transportation. If more of these people, both in Mat-Su and statewide, could receive care in lower-cost settings, they and the state would be better off for it. The prevalence of mental health and substance use problems and crises are increasing in Mat-Su and statewide. The average annual growth rate for visits to the Mat-Su Regional ED, by patients with a behavioral health diagnosis grew 20% from 2015 to 2017 due to the opioid epidemic and lack of treatment access. Additionally, from 2014 to 17, the number of behavioral health assessments required for patients in crisis in our ED grew from 349 to 1,000, again, all in a hospital that does not provide behavioral health care. This legislation could help bring the appropriate level of care to people who need help when a problem first starts, when it's mild to moderate, instead of after it develops into a crisis and warrants an ED visit. In the Mat-Su Health Foundation's 2013 Mat-Su Community Health Needs Assessment, the people of Mat-Su voted in 24 community forums that the top health issues in Mat-Su, the top five, were all related to mental health and substance abuse. Mat-Su citizens want an improved and coordinated system of care that makes treatment for behavioral health more readily accessible. Thousands of Alaskans of all ages, children, families, and older Alaskans are struggling with these mental health and substance use issues. But they cannot access providers and payer sources to meet the need. This legislation helps address these issues. It was a policy recommendation in our behavioral health environmental scan, which we published, and specifically states that if we change the statute to allow marriage and family therapists and licensed professional counselors and others to bill Medicaid, this will allow us to meet those upstream costs. Just in closing, the Mat-Su Health Foundation is also doing its part to build out the behavioral health continuum of care, and we've made grants to organizations to fill gaps in the continuum of care. We have a special project that we're financing to reduce super utilizers in our emergency department, and we advocate for smart policy like SB 105, which we hope you will move this important legislation forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ripley. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Machicki.
Yeah, we haven't really gotten to this part yet, but I'm just a little bit worried about the fiscal note and the assumptions in it. We have in every other category of Medicaid, we have seen a much higher utilization rate than we ever assumed. In fact, that climbs on a monthly basis. The governor has asked for $18 million, I believe, other dollars for behavioral health. Just wondering, do we have a comprehensive view of this, or are we just sort of throwing solutions? Because I'd like to know that we understand what we're offering and that someone is matching that to the need as opposed to exposing the state to more overutilization. Just wondering about your – we've dealt with other issues together, so I think you think through some of these things. Just curious what your answer might be.
Senator Machicki, through the chair. There is another project out there, the Alaska Healthcare Blueprint, which strives to do just that, take a big, bolder, broader look at what our health objectives are. Certainly in MATSU, we try to really work collaboratively with our state partners, with our providers, and our local delegation to try to take that comprehensive view. The behavioral health environmental scan that I mentioned, we really do our homework at the MATSU Health Foundation. It was a three-part scan. The first part looked at the crisis response system. The second part looked at the entire continuum of care for behavioral health in MATSU. And the third part looked upstream at what our prevention sort of system looks like. And then we have convened behavioral health providers and primary care providers in MATSU and brought in expertise to help dialogue and to chip away and to try to, one, create that broader vision and plan that you talk about, and two, really address the low-hanging fruit on the care coordination level. Part of what we have to do is acknowledge that we need to provide whole health to individuals, and we've created two systems of care in our country and in our state, one for physical health and one for mental health and addiction. And the truth is we're one person until we bring those systems together and pay appropriately and plan appropriately for whole person care. This is what we're going to get these costs. But I could just add one more thing to your cost, your fiscal note on this. Yes, there will be additional costs, right? These LPCs and licensed and marriage family therapists will be able to bill. But in 2013, we spent $23 million on these behavioral health visits at MATSU Regional, and in 2016, $43.8 million. It's going to be a lot more cost effective at this growth rate to work upstream and have these providers be able to bill than to accumulate ED charges, which again, right now we're not providing ED care. We don't provide site care, but we are trying to get those improvements at our hospital.
Thank you for that comment. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. My comments will be brief. I think what I'm hearing from Ms. Ripley to address Senator Marchicki's question is that hopefully rather than an additional fiscal note, we're going to instead shift the costs from expensive ER visits to more clinic visits where we serve the same population for the same ailments but in a different cost environment. So the fiscal note, I think, is kind of, I'm hoping, going to go down ultimately. It's not like we're adding new population. We're just serving them in a different way. That's just my impression. Thank you.
Much better said.
Other questions for Ms. Ripley? Thank you for testifying before Senate Finance. I'd like to invite John Zasda, Alaska Primary Care, to the microphone. Robin, you're next to testify. Okay.
Good morning, Committee Chair McKinnon and members of the committee. My name is John Zazada. I'm the Policy Director for the Alaska Primary Care Association. We are the Association of Alaska's Federally Qualified Health Centers. There are 27 federally qualified health centers operating at 160 sites throughout the state. Expanding the behavioral health billable labor force has been the number one priority of Alaska health centers for the last 2 years. We strongly support SB 105, and we thank each of you who took the time last week to meet with health centers during our fly-in on this issue. Health centers have made major investments in behavioral health integration and whole person care. Over the last 2 years, we've seen 25% increase in the number of behavioral health providers, encounters, and patients. Over 11,000 Alaskans receive routine behavioral health care in Alaska's community health centers. There is a shortage of billable providers. In a study that we just completed in December, Alaska community health centers are short 12 to 18 FTE equivalents. This would translate into additional service to between 6,000 and 9,000 patients. We do want to stress that federally qualified health centers save money by allowing same-day appointments at a single rate, a single bundled billable encounter. If LMFTs were included in FQHC Medicaid billing, a patient could see a medical provider and a mental health professional in the same day for a single charge instead of a referral to two separate charges. Currently, health centers are only able to bill Medicaid under the FQHC rate for behavioral health providers provided by a psychiatrist, PsyD, or LCSW. Health centers also employ LPCs and LMFTs but cannot bill Medicaid. They are primarily paid through earned revenue and federal health center grant funds. Health centers continue to attract major additional investment in behavioral health integration and substance abuse treatment from the federal government with the goal of serving more patients in comprehensive whole patient settings. In 2017, 24 health centers received $3.4 million through the Access Increases for Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services program from HRSA. The majority of these funds would be spent on hiring additional providers. Unluckily, they are not sustainable funds unless there is additional opportunity to bill Medicaid. With the recently passed two-year federal health center authorization and new funding for addressing the opioid epidemic, we expect additional direction and incentives from HRSA to continue these initiatives. And I think finally we would just say we are very interested in opportunities to address the 30% supervision rule. We're trying to get additional information on how this could be offset in response to a meeting that we had with Senator Michicki last week, and we're still working on that. Thank you.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Stevens.
I just want to clarify. You were talking about who can bill the Medicaid, and you said PsyD, and I believe you mean a doctor of psychology, someone with a PhD in psychology. Who are the others who can bill Medicaid?
Right now, through the chair, Senator Stevens, licensed clinical social workers and doctors of psychology.
Thank you.
Follow-up, Senator Stevens?
No, thank you. That answers my question.
Other questions from committee members? Thank you for testifying before Senate Finance today. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on the CS for Senate Bill 105, off-net or here in Juneau? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. We will not be going over fiscal notes today. We should be receiving a new fiscal note from the Department of Administration. Senator Wilson, any closing comments for the committee's consideration, specifically on your fiscal note, at least the one we have from Medicaid Services, Allocation Behavioral Health, 2660. I'm wondering about the split between the general fund match and the higher federal match, so I'll be asking the department that. But we do expect to receive a new fiscal note. So I just wanted to let you know that that's one of the questions I'll have.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wilson, for the record. I agree with Senator Von Imhoff's statement and the statement from Elizabeth Ripley, director of the Massey Health Foundation, that these patients are out there. They're going to be seen one way or another, and the backlog means that they will be seen either this year, next year, or the future year. And so it's not trying to create a new expanded care of treatment, but just giving those patients the access to that care or the earlier primary prevention. And so with that, I thank the time of the committee and the Madam Chair for hearing the bill.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. Are there questions from committee members? Thank you, Senator Wilson. I would like amendments to Senate Bill 105 tomorrow, 5 p.m. Wednesday, from committee members or any concerns or questions that we need to advance to the department for our next conversation around this bill. I'd like to ask committee members to pull their file for SB 165, Comprehensive Health Insurance Fund. And I'd like to invite Brittany Hartman from my staff to introduce the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Brittany Hartman, staff to Senator McKinnon. Before you today is Senate Bill 165, an extension of the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Fund. This bill extends the sunset of the ACHIEF Fund for 6 years from June 30th, 2018 to June 30th, 2024. The reason for the extension is to continue to stabilize the individual health care market in Alaska and to be in compliance with the federal award. The state of Alaska was granted a federal 1332 innovation waiver that provides us with $322 million in federal funds over a period of 5 years. This federal money and approval is contingent on the passage of this bill. I would like to clarify for the committee that the federal funds are guaranteed for 5 years. However, this bill is requesting a 6-year extension for two reasons. One is to true up all claims, and two is because the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services have indicated that they may approve 1332 waivers for an additional year. And I would also like to point out to the committee, or remind the committee, that the state saw a $25 million surplus in the supplemental due to the profits made by Primera thanks to this reinsurance program.
Senators, as you know, we've had this bill before us several years ago. We had two insurers in the individual market in our system, and one was getting ready to exit because of the unprofitability of the small Alaska market for their consideration. We watched also as other West Coast states were experiencing at the same time difficulties with their insurance, and that same carrier was looking at whether they would stay in those particular states also. This bill before you, Ms. Hartman has adequately, actually excellently, told you exactly what it will do, and that is create a stable market. We saw a reduction in premiums for Alaskans by this particular program, and it will also rededicate the revenue stream out of the insurance fund and into the general fund, which I believe is a positive fiscal note of about $50 million in its current proposal annually to the general fund budget with those insurance premiums going to the general fund versus inside of the insurance fund. With that, I'd like to ask Lori Winghire to the microphone. Senator Von Himhoff, questions?
I'll wait till Ms. Winghire comes and I'll ask her this question. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you. Ms. Winghire, first I'd like to acknowledge your service to the people of Alaska, specifically in the insurance market. As many of you know, Alaska was looking to be a standalone market, which would create no competition for this particular vehicle in our state. And through your leadership and with this administration, you proposed asking the legislature to create a pool to try to stabilize the individual market and the opportunity for time to go forward and ask the federal government to be able to show them how we could reduce insurance premiums for all Alaskans entering the insurance market. So I just wanted to thank you publicly. I know that you're being recognized nationally, and that other states are following Alaska's lead in trying to manage the care on this particular group of people who are sometimes high cost and have limited access to health care. So on behalf of Senate Finance, and I hope that I can speak for the legislature as a whole, I wanted to publicly thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you.
If you could provide us comments on SB 165 for this committee's consideration.
Certainly. For the record, I am Lori Winghire. I'm the director of the Division of Insurance. And Senate Bill 165 is allowing us to continue the reinsurance program with significant federal funding because of the 1332 waiver for a period of 5 years, which is what the current waiver is, but also allows for a sixth year if and when the CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, allows the waiver, gives us an extension of 1 year. We were backing up to 2016. Senator McKinnon and many of you were instrumental, and Senator Costello, Senator Giesel, I mean, I remember it was special session. We were over at the Billy Ray Center. We were holding hearings. it's fiscal crisis, and we were asking for $55 million. It was a hard decision, but we also knew we were down to one insurer, and we also knew the rate increases the individual market was taking. We looked at what we thought we had an idea for the reinsurance program. We also thought we had a chance at receiving federal funding. You, in looking at the program and at the crisis, the fiscal crisis of the state, gave us a two-year period to run the reinsurance program and to find alternative funding. When the bill was passed and signed in July of 2016, we immediately began application for the federal waiver. It was submitted in early January of 2017. And last year in July, we received our award that our waiver was approved, and it has become nationally recognized. Many states are following or have followed in the footsteps of what Alaska did. Oregon has a waiver. Minnesota has a waiver, and there's probably 17 states that are working with their legislature right now to do the same thing that Alaska is doing. With the sunset date and now knowing that we have a contract, a signed waiver with the federal government for an estimated $322 million over a period of 5 years, for us to accept those funds, we need the sunset date either removed or extended. This will also allow that the tax that the department or the division collects, the premium tax that is collected, will go back to the general fund as it was intended. And that, in essence, is what this bill is asking for you to do.
Maury, could you it gets very confusing in watching and trying to follow policy. We call it sausage making sometimes. Could you explain to the general public what reinsurance is? So when you brought this idea forward, Senate Finance specifically, I remember it was a hot, sunny day, and the room was packed in trying to walk through a particular group of Alaskans that were causing the market insurance premiums to skyrocket in our state. And so we were reinsuring a particular group, taking them out of the insurance pool. Can you talk to that just briefly for Alaskans? Senator Bishop?
Sorry, ma'am, if you just give me 60 seconds of liberty to ask
please.
This, because I have to go. I just want to say that for one lawmaker, you can break down a complicated issue that even I can understand it, and you do it all the time. I trust you. You delivered on what you said you were going to try to do, and keep up the good work. I have to go. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Reinsurance, in this case, if you are an individual in Alaska and you purchase through the individual market, but are then diagnosed with end-stage renal disease, many of the cancers, because if you remember, we listed 30-some conditions that we were going to transfer to the reinsurance program. Hemophilia, they were numerous, Parkinson's, high-cost claims. So you would still buy your insurance from Primera, and because that's the only carrier we have. You may never know that your claim behind the scenes is being picked up, has been ceded to the Alaska Reinsurance Program, and is not really being paid by Primera, but is being paid by the state through this program. What that does is then the cost of the claims reduce the overall claims expense for the insurer, so that when they do a rate filing with us, we've removed in 2017 $55 million worth of high-cost claims. We're removing just under $60 million in 2018. That resulted in close to a 25% decrease, average decrease, in the individual market, because we are paying for those claims. The state is reinsuring them behind Primera. And that, in essence, is how the program works. But many individuals probably don't know what you did in the fact that their claims are being paid by the state, and now by the federal government and the state.
Ms. Wingheyer, and why is the federal government interested in paying for these? And so what I want to describe for Alaskans is the federal government goes through a process under the 1332 waiver to see if there's a net benefit to the federal government in spending. Can you speak to that, of why this program was approved by the federal government?
Certainly, Madam Chair. Many of Alaskans, a high percentage, are subsidized. They're low income, so they are subsidized, meaning that their premiums in the individual market are actually paid by the federal government. There is no cap on those premiums. We could have continued to raise premiums 40%, 50%, and the federal government still would have paid for low income and moderate income those premiums. Our waiver said if we can reduce the claims, if we take the claims out of the calculation and the premiums don't increase, but they decrease, the federal government is going to save money. And we ask for that money to come back to us to fund the reinsurance program. So it's a pass-through. Had we not passed it, the reinsurance program, had it not been enacted, the federal government's claims or the federal government's premiums for the low and moderate income would have continued to skyrocket, as would those that do not receive subsidies. But in doing this way, we reduced what they're paying in premiums. They're giving us the difference back through the reinsurance program to fund our program going forward. That's brought claims down for the entire individual market.
And one last follow-up. Senate Finance did, during that sunny special session day, ask for you to work with Department of Health and Social Services and look at managed care for this particular population. Are we any closer to managing the care of those individuals that are high-cost drivers in our system?
Madam Chair, if you would look, and I'm happy to provide it, the plan of operation and the rules that we've put in place with Primera and the administrator, which is a facility that has been administering Alaska's high-risk pool when we actually have a CHIA, the high-risk pool, we have very strict guidelines for managed care for these consumers, so that they're getting adequate care, but that what the money that we are paying, state and now state and federal, is being spent wisely. So we are trying very hard to provide managed care on every claimant that comes through this program.
Thank you. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And continuing on the idea of making this simple enough for me to understand it, could you explain the $25 million from Primera, why that occurred, and are there expectations there will be similar returns in the future?
Madam Chair, Senator Stevens, I don't expect there will be similar returns. About this time last year, maybe a little bit further into the year, 2017, Primera came to us and said, we knew that the enrollment numbers were down, but at the same time, they had lost some of the high-risk claimants, and claims had taken a steep dive. There was no explanation for it. We considered it an anomaly. We don't know if these individuals have moved to Medicaid expansion, if they have just decided they cannot afford health insurance, the cost of it. But the claims had gone down. Now, to back up, when an insurance company files rates with the state of Alaska, they put in what we call a contingency, and it's their profit. And we look at anywhere from 3 to 5% profit. And that is in the rate filing. Primera knew they were in excess of that. And they came to us involuntarily, asked to put the money back into the reinsurance program for 2017. And we did a stipulated agreement with them, or a memorandum of understanding, without any fault on the part of Primera, that the money came back to the state.
Senator Stevens.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on that, do you expect conditions now where we are that will lead to further insurers being involved in Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, we are very hopeful that we will see an additional insurer. We've certainly had some outreach from other insurers that may look. MOTA in particular has expressed a desire to come back. I think the reluctance right now is not on the part of the state, but in watching what's going on in D.C., and when that settles down, whatever it is, I think you will see insurers want to come back to Alaska.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I like Senator Bishop. I appreciate being explained so I can understand it. Thank you.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So
Ms. Wing-Hire, you mentioned that this waiver with the federal government's 5 years with potential for 1 year extension. What happens in year seven? And so my question is there a way for us to save as much money right now in the reinsurance program? I know that they mentioned that the premium tax collected as was intended is going to go into the general fund, I understand, but is there a way for us to at least manage to the best of our ability other than coordinated care, but to hold back as much of the money as we can for year seven and eight in the event that the waiver is not extended a second time and we don't have federal subsidies?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, we have certainly considered that. We think right now that the fund, what we're receiving from the federal government, is appropriate, that we may be able to go into the sixth year. We received approximately $10 million more in 2018 than we were anticipating. The reason being our analysis was on the raw premium. When the waiver was approved and we began negotiations on how much money should come to Alaska, we brought up the topic of basically the variable expenses, that being the premium tax, the tax that is part of the Affordable Care Act, administrative expenses, the expense they have to pay to be on the exchange, that also was being saved, and it resulted in about another $10 million coming into our program. That means that in 2018, when we thought we were going to have to put in about 10 to 11 million estate funds, we're only putting in 1.5. In 2017, this body appropriated 55 million to carry us through the 5-year period of the waiver for the state contribution. If we can continue to see those numbers from the federal government where we're only putting in 1.5 instead of what we anticipated as 10, we think we will have enough funding to carry it into the sixth year and possibly the seventh. At the same time, we are working very hard with others, including yourself, through the Alaska Comprehensive Health Plan, to address the cost of health care. And that can make a big difference in what we need for this program in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff. Are there any other questions about how the bill functions? Seeing and hearing none, I'd like to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 165. Is there anyone here in Juneau or off-net wishing to testify on Senate Bill 165, an act relating to the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Fund and providing for an effective date? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. Senator Hoffman, could we cover the fiscal note?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The fiscal note for Senate Bill 165, the first one is from the Department of Administration, appropriation for the Centralized Administrative Services. Allocation is finance, OMB component number is 59. It is a zero fiscal note, and the analysis is that the bill would extend the repeal date for the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Fund statute from June 30th of 18 to June 30th of 24, and effective July 1st of 2018, would deposit insurance premium tax revenues into the general fund instead of the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Fund. The general fund and the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Funds are existing funds, and the change should require minimal work with no significant fiscal impact for the Division of Finance. Therefore, the Division of Finance submits this zero fiscal note. The second fiscal note is from the Department of Commerce and Community and Economic Development, appropriation, insurance operations, allocation, insurance operations. OMB component number is 354. This fiscal note is also a zero fiscal note. And the analysis behind this fiscal note is that this legislation extends the sunset provision of the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Fund by 6 years from June 30th, 2018 to June 30th, 2024. This legislation also removes the requirement that the fund collect under AS 2021-09-210 and Alaska Statutes 21-33-055 and Alaska Statutes 21-34-180 and Alaska Statutes 21-66-110 are to be deposited into the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Fund within the general fund.
Are there questions on the fiscal note? Ms. Wingheyer, I have a question. So as I understand it, the current insurance receipts that are designated general fund would be rerouted into the general fund. Is there a reason why we're not seeing a projection on what that new general fund contribution would be?
Through the chair, I believe that we have spoke, that I know that the $25 million has been addressed, that there has been in the supplemental. We also have, we have brought forward that we believe that the current fund probably has, because we were basically given 3 years of state taxes to fund 2 years, because that was the period of the program. So there is about $63 million that would be rerouted back to the general fund, and going forward, all of the taxes would go back. I hope that answered your question.
Well, it does. I'm aware of ballpark numbers that you have just alluded to, but I'm wondering why it's not reflected on the fiscal note as revenue coming in to the general fund. So we see when revenue is going out, right. And I'm wondering why this isn't saying that whatever those projected receipts are specifically, not necessarily the one-time money, because sometimes those one-time monies wouldn't show up on a fiscal note but would just show up, basically. But this is an ongoing change in a revenue stream, and so I'm wondering why it's not reflected in the fiscal note.
Madam Chair, I don't know that I have the answer, but I will get you the answer today on that.
Thank you. With that, I'd like to set this bill aside. Amendments are due on Wednesday by 5 p.m. It is my expectation to move the bill on Thursday morning if there's support of the committee. So just it's a bill that so far is zero public testimony, no opposition that's known, and a plus to the state's bottom line. But again, I'll look for the committee support in moving this forward. I would like to see a fiscal note if it is appropriate to reflect the revenue stream change. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Ms. Hartman, did you have any closing comments for our consideration on the bill?
No, madam. Thank you.
With that, thank you for extending your stay in finance today. We're adjourned.